With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey legends, welcome on the podcast. Today is Joanne, the founder of Tennis Legend, asking questions to Dani Valverdu, this pretty famous coach that was along Thomas Berdych, Stan Wawrinka, Andy Murray, Grigor Dimitrov. If you're on YouTube, put a like on the video and 5 stars on Spotify or Apple Podcast. I hope you like this interview. Cheers.
So, just want to know, you were born in Venezuela.
Correct.
And at what age did you start tennis?
I started when I was 6 years old. My family, they're not a tennis family, but it was always part of our club where we used to go. So they used to play socially, but nothing too serious. My sister also played, she's a year younger. And she started actually before me. I was doing swimming and tennis from the age of 6 till 10. So I was doing both. And at 10, I had to make the decision if I was going to do one or the other one. When my swimming coach told me that I needed to start coming to swim before school at 6 in the morning, I said, I think I'm gonna pick tennis. So I don't have to wake up every day at 5 to go swimming in the cold water. So that was an easy decision to pick tennis, and I'm happy I did that. So, and then after 10, I focused just on tennis, living in Venezuela. And I moved from Venezuela when I was 15, moved to Florida for 1 year.
Okay.
I did 1 year of training there at the Nunez Clark Academy in Aventura, Florida. And then at 16, I moved to Barcelona to the Sanchez Casal Academy, which I was there from 16 to 19.
And you met Andy Murray at the Sanchez Casal Academy in Barcelona. Yeah. And I read you, it was your best friend.
Yeah, we were very close. I was there before him, and then when he arrived, we actually his first practice in Barcelona when he arrived, he's a year younger. They made him play with me, so I was the first person that he was on court at the academy. And then we had lunch that day as well after practice, and we became very close friends. And then, yeah, the 3 years that I was there, he was there for 2.5 years. We became very close friends, and then at 19 I went to university in Miami. And he was already playing pros and doing very well at 18. But then we kept the friendship, because when I moved to Miami for university, he bought a place in Miami and he was doing all of his training there. So we kept the friendship and the relationship going, and we were doing some of the training together even when I was in university. So I was still kind of close to him and his team, even though I was not on tour with him.
In Venezuela, you were among the best player, I think.
Yeah, I was number one under all the age groups, under 10, 12, 14, 16. So yeah, me and my sister, we were both number one in the country throughout the whole junior career. Yeah.
And with Andy Murray at Sanchez Casal Academy, do you see something? Do you think he was better than the others?
Yeah, definitely. Even from the first day he was there, you could tell he was a different player. I mean, already you could tell the talent and the things that he could do at that age was different than anybody else that was in the academy. And I saw a big shift from 16 to 18 in the potential. Obviously, he was very good at 16, but already at 18, he was playing like a pro player. The way he was hitting the ball, his mindset and approach towards the game plan, he was already very mature at a very young age. He was definitely standing out compared to all the other guys in the academy.
Do you have funny memories with him when he was a teenager? Because no. You were both teenagers.
Yeah, not that many. I would rather not share. We keep those to ourselves. But we had a lot of fun. I mean, it was we were very close, me and Andy, and then we had another friend. His name is Carlos. He was from Peru, and the three of us, we spent most of our time together, and we had a great time. It was I always say if I had to do it again, I would love to do it again. It was a great time in Barcelona. And the friendship that we developed, obviously, it was very special for me in particular, and I'm sure it was for them as well.
So then you went to the uni at Miami.
Yeah.
And why did you choose to go to the university?
So I was playing professionally the futures tournaments in Barcelona after finishing school at 18. I was doing okay. I was making finals of futures in Spain. So I was already ranked at 18, 19, around 700. Like I said, making semis and finals of futures in Spain. But my father wanted me to go to university and get my degree. So I told him, okay, if you want me to go to university, I'm only going to Miami, even though I had offers from a lot of other different ones. But I spent most of my childhood going to Florida.
Okay.
So as a family, we went a lot. We had a holiday home there from a very young age. So I had a lot of relationships throughout the years in Miami. And a lot of my Venezuelan friends had moved to Miami as well. So that was the compromise that I did with my father. I said, okay, I'll go to university, but only if I go to the University of Miami. And then, yeah, I did my 4 years there from 2006 till 2009. Yeah.
But you wanted to keep on the futures, to do futures and tournament, or you want... to go to
no
to
I, w- the... I wanted to keep playing. I felt that I was improving a lot, and it was a time where already I felt at that age starting to make futures and finals in Spain were good results, obviously not the same compared to what Andy was doing, but I thought I was progressing and I wanted to give it a try to see how it was going to go. But the agreement that I had with my father was that, okay, I'll do my 4 years, I'll take my tennis very seriously, which I did in university. I mean, I got to number 3 in the nation in singles and number 1 in the nation in doubles at NCAA. So I took it very seriously and I enjoyed it. And actually, that's another part of my life that I would do it again. I am now very happy that my father made me do that. I had a great time, built a lot of friendships, obviously educated myself, now I have a university degree, and I think I was in a good place to then play professionally again when I was 22, 23 after graduating. Then I was playing my first futures tournament back in Venezuela after the university, and was in the finals of singles and doubles. Had a groin injury in the middle of the match, and then from that groin injury I had to get surgery. So literally I finished college.
It was in 2009, so?
2009, yeah, yes. Correct, yeah, in 2009 in the summer. And then I had surgery for the problem that I had in my groin. And then I stopped playing for about 6 months. And then in the middle of 2010, when I was recovering to try and play again, that's when Andy had just stopped with one of his coaches at the time. And he was doing his summer training in 2010 in Miami. And I was there also recovering and spending time with him. And he said, look, I need to go now to Canada, Cincinnati, US Open, and I don't have a coach. Do you want to come just to help me out? It wasn't to go with him to coach him. It was more as a friend. I had the time and just to help him with some of the tennis stuff. And yeah, I guess it went really well from the beginning. At the first tournament that I was there with him, he beat Rafa in the semis, Roger in the final at the Toronto Masters. And then from then onwards, it went really well, and he asked me if I wanted to take the job seriously or not. So I had to make the decision if I was going to keep playing myself or try to play myself or to take the job with him. And at the time, I was almost 24. And I said, look, I think this is a good opportunity. I think I can try it maybe for half a year or a year and see how it goes and see if actually it works for Andy. And if it doesn't, maybe later I can look to come back and play myself again. But then, yeah, the coaching relationship with him went extremely well. So then, yeah, 12 years later, here I am.
Is it easy when you are only 24, as maybe the youngest tennis coach on the tour, to find something to say to Andy?
Again, for me, it wasn't... At the beginning, I didn't take the position as Andy's coach because I didn't feel like a coach. Also, in my mind, I never even imagined or thought that's what I want to be. So I was more at the beginning helping a friend with my tennis knowledge that I had, but I didn't feel like I was coaching him. But during that time, especially the first year and a half that I was with him, I was extremely lucky to have very good people around us on the team that I learned so much from. So the first 12 months that I was traveling with Andy, we had Darren Cahill helping us, so he was part of the Adidas team at the time, and Andy was sponsored by Adidas during that time, so Darren was spending a lot of weeks with us, so I learned so much from him, and he was a real good mentor for me. He took me under his wing and taught me a lot. And then the year after, in 2012, Ivan Lendl comes in the team, which also took me under his wing, and I was very fortunate to be around Darren first, and then around Ivan as well. Then also at the beginning of the relationship, I forgot to mention, Correggia, Alex Correggia was also helping him during that time. So I had Alex, Darren, and Ivan during the first 2 years of my career, where I learned, I mean, everything I know now is because of them, or most of my traits as a coach now come from what I learned from those guys. So that's what I think helped me to kind of dive into the coaching profession. It was like, okay, I'm just helping a friend, trying to do the best I can. And at the same time, during those 2 years, I was learning a lot from these guys, and obviously also learning from Andy, because I mean, for me, from all the players that I've worked with, he's the one that I've definitely learned the most, because he's the guy that is pushing the team a lot every day to be better. I think between the coaches that were there and were mentoring me, plus Andy's demanding attitude, made me into the coach that I am now. So I was very fortunate to have that experience at the beginning.
So you don't have a coaching diploma?
No, I don't. I don't. So the diploma that I have is my tennis career, and then working with a top 3 player in the world in my early years, which I think it doesn't get you don't get a better coaching experience on the day to day, and how to understand what the real standards are. And what to do to meet those standards, and what to do to make progress as a coach to try and help the players. So I think I was very fortunate to get a first-hand experience at the highest level. You know, so it was an express MBA, an express MBA into coaching.
How does it work with Alex or Darren or what is the last one?
Ivan.
Ivan. Yeah. Yes. How does it work? You talk with them, and then they talk to Andy, or you talk to Andy directly? Or?
It depends how. If we were sharing the weeks, we would find a way to do it together. Obviously, when I was not there, I would keep in touch with them, and then I was the one delivering the message to Andy. But it was a combination. I was very lucky that they encouraged my position. They were very supportive of my role in the team, and they were very supportive of making sure that I was developing as a coach. So like I told you just now, for me, their help was crucial in my coaching career. There could have been some coaches around the team that maybe were not as supportive of me or didn't want to teach me so much at the beginning, but they were fantastic. So I'm always extremely grateful to those 3 guys that they took me almost like a son, which was really nice, and we still have a great relationship.
So you worked with Murray, Berdych, Del Potro.
Del Potro for a short period of time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stan Wawrinka and yeah. Dimitrov and Karolina Pliskova.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me just few words to describe each player? So let's start with Andy.
If I had one word for each.
Just few words.
Passionate. Driven and demanding. That would be for Andy. For
Thomas,
I would say consistent, hard worker, and third word for Thomas. What would I describe him? Consistent, hard worker, and good person.
Delpo, even he was just a few.
Yeah, Delpo, competitive, very professional, and a very kind heart.
Stan?
Funny, very, extremely competitive, and a warrior mentality that he has, which is never give up, and even when things are not going well, he's still trying to find a way to get through difficult moments. I think he has a warrior mentality.
Dimitrov?
Artistic. hard worker.
Yes.
A great person to be around on a daily basis. But I would say, for me as a coach, the the biggest attribute from him is that he's an extremely hard worker that that is always very receptive and open to listen to advice.
What kind of coach are you? Are you tough? Are you cool? Are you?
I'm tough. Yeah, I'm tough. Yeah. I'm tough because I believe that our job as coach of top professional tennis players, we need to understand that we cannot waste time, and not for us, but we cannot waste their time. So there's no time to be stepping on glass or on eggshells. For us, we have to be as direct and honest as possible. And that sometimes can come across as tough, but it's part of our job, and we need to feel that free to say what we think without being scared of maybe the consequences or how it comes across, because our job is to maximize the potential that the players have today. Because in professional sports, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Always with eyes in the future to try and plan the schedule and the training, thinking long term, but always the delivery of the message and the mindset has to be how can we maximize what we have today. And of course, you have to be smart about the volumes of training and the loads, thinking long term, because obviously, hopefully, all the players will have a long career. But mentally, you're always trying to push them to try and be as good as they can today.
Is it important to find the good words to talk to your players?
And more than the good words, the timing. For me, always the timing of the delivery of the information is the most important too. Understand the player when they're the most receptive for you to share the message. And this is something that with experience you get to understand maybe when are the right moments to say it. But I can say something to him just now after the match, or I can say it at dinner, and it can be taken from him in a completely different way. So I think timing of information is very important.
What was your biggest argument with a player and why? Why? What was the subject of the argument?
I don't think I've had a big argument with a player, if I'm fully honest, in the last 12, 13 years. Maybe sometimes when Andy was difficult to me in the box, I would tell him that maybe during that match, maybe he shouldn't have said a couple things that he said, but they were not arguments really. It was more like I do with all the other players, or like I did with all the other players. If I thought something was right or wrong, I would say it, and maybe it creates some uncomfortable situation for a couple of minutes, but it always turns out to be okay. But I really cannot pick one. I mean, it doesn't right now. It doesn't come to my head one big argument with any of the players.
Andy Murray, he speaks a lot during a match, yeah. And how do you take it when he yells at you?
You can take. I mean, he's not a lot of it. 99% of it, he doesn't mean. Sometimes he doesn't. He's not even aware of it at the end of the match. And every most important thing as a coach, you need to understand that every player is different and every player deals with pressure in a different way. Of course, as a coach, you're trying to, for me, the key is to understand, is what he's doing on the court, is it making his performance worse, or is keeping it the same, or is making it better? If there is a situation in a match where a player is doing something and I feel that their attitude is making them play worse, then after the match, I will say, look, it's not what the player was telling you or what the player was telling someone else. It's just a simple question. Was this making them play worse? If it was making them play worse, then you say, look, what you were doing was making you play worse. Try not to do it again. So that has to be the mindset. It's not what he's saying or how they're doing. It is the effect that action is having on the match. Because some players, they might be doing something and it's a way for them to relax. And they actually find a way to get back in a match, or they feel better. So you need to understand the effect. Let's say even with Andy, like if in some of the matches he was being very vocal towards the box, if that made him play worse, then after the match I would say, look, in this situation, when you were getting vocal to the box, you were playing worse. But sometimes maybe it doesn't make him play bad. And then you say, look, during this time actually it was okay, but just be aware that sometimes it makes you play worse. So it's just about seeing the effect that their behavior has on the result of the match.
What is the most important thing for you to be a good coach?
You need to adaptability. You need to be able to adapt not only to different players but different situations, and understanding that it's important to have a way of coaching and a regime of coaching and an idea on how to do things, but it's important to be able to adapt. I always say 80-20. There's a 20% that you should be able to move around. And even with one player, every week is different, every day is different, so you always have to leave 20% where you need to try and work with the player and try and work together. There's 80% for me that is okay. For me, this is how things are done, and this is what we're gonna do. And then there's 20% that I'm always trying to come to terms with the player. You know, depending on the day, depending on the week. Yeah.
How do you try to improve to be a better coach?
For me, at the moment, I've been working with really top players where the tactical side of the game is very important. So for me, I watch a lot of matches, and not only matches from my player, but from other players, to try and understand. I think of my player and I say, okay, when I'm watching these matches, how is this going to hurt my player, and what can my player do to find ways around this situation? So I'm constantly watching matches and taking notes on how I need to train my player to try and prevent certain situations in matches from what I've seen. I mean, I watch thousands of matches. So I would say the tactical side of the game is very important for my current job. I'm not developing technique. I'm not developing a junior. So at the moment, I focus on what I need to do to be a better coach for these top players. If maybe later in my career I'm coaching a younger player or a junior, then I would have to focus on improving the technical side or on the mental formation, which I haven't done in the last 13 years. I mean, I've worked with a certain type of athlete or a tennis player, but I'm flexible that if in the future I'm coaching someone younger and I need to focus on different areas of the game, then I will have to educate myself to do that.
Okay. Yeah. What is your best quality as a coach and your weakness, if you're one? Or more?
Best quality as a coach? I'm very direct. No bullshit, which I think is very important for top athletes. I think they appreciate the directness of my message. And my weakness as a coach, probably have a few, so I'm just gonna pick one. My weakness is a coach. Let me try and pick the softest one, because I probably have a few.
It's good to know them.
Trust. I need to learn how to trust the player more. So what I mean by trust is to not always feel that that my input is necessary. You know, like sometimes, okay, these guys are good enough. Don't feel like you need to be on top of them. But that's also my competitive side. I'm very competitive, so I'm always trying to be there to make sure that things are going the right way. But maybe sometimes I need to be more comfortable stepping back and letting things flow.
Yeah. Of all the players you've coached, who was the easiest to coach?
Berdych. Yeah, Berdych was the easiest one. He was, like I said, extremely hard worker, very professional. Very consistent every day, and a good guy. So in general, it was, I think the easiest job I had with him. I mean, not the easiest, but I would say the day-to-day was less stressful. That's how I would put it.
Are you really very stressed?
No, I mean, I'm very, the weakness of my personality, I'm quite controlling. So that makes me sometimes be a little bit stressed, because especially in tennis, as a coach, you're sitting, you're not playing, so you can't control the result. So that brings some stress, but nothing too crazy. At the end of the day, I am very well aware that it's a game, and we're very privileged to be in this position here, watching the best tennis in the world, helping the best athletes in the world. So I often remind myself that it's a game, and of course, if we lose, it hurts, but there are worse places to be. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And the most difficult player to coach?
I'm not gonna tell you that. you can make that assumption yourself. But to be honest, now I'm not just saying this because you asked the question. But I've been very, very lucky in my career to be not only with the level of players that I have, because I think I honestly believe that the player makes the coach. I think the coach helps. But I've been lucky to work with incredible tennis players that that have helped my coaching career. Of course, I gave my input and few grains of salt that helped them. But the guys that I worked with, they were all fantastic human beings and top professionals. So to be honest, okay, you can always pick one that was more difficult than the other one. But in general, I was very lucky with the guys that I've coached.
My question was not in a bad way. Just
No, I know. But like I said, they're not none of them stand out as being one more difficult than the other one. They're difficult in different ways.
Okay. Yeah. Is it difficult to find something to say, to see something wrong in the game of the best player in the world?
No, there's always. I mean,
really?
Always things to improve. Always, and that's my job as a coach. You need to make progress every day, every week, every month. The game, first of all, their strengths are not going to be at the top level every week, so you need to focus on keeping the strengths as good as they can be, because that's what builds their game, that's what builds their confidence. And then there's always going to be small weaknesses here and there. Every player has, no player is perfect. Every player has a small percentage to improve in some areas of the game. As a coach, my view is that you shouldn't focus at this level. With younger players, developing players is different, but at this level of coaching, you should never be too obsessed about the things that are not good or about the weaknesses. You should definitely be aware of them, but number one is to make sure that the strengths are as good as they can be, because that's what builds their confidence. Then the second step that I try and use, I'm not saying it's the right one, but it's my approach, is to use the strengths to cover the weaknesses tactically. And then the third step is to also work on the weaknesses, but I would put them third on the list. I would say work on the strengths. Number two, use the strengths to cover the weaknesses. And number three, try and slowly improve some of the weaknesses, which, like, I mean, I get where your question is coming from. There are not so many, but there's always things to improve.
Yes, but for a player like me who is not a professional, when I see like Dimitrov,
yeah,
I think his technique is like perfect, but yeah, you see some weakness?
I mean, not like, I don't focus so much on the technique.
Okay.
At this level, I think their technique for most of them is where it should be, and I don't tinker with the technique very much. For me, it's more about shot selection, movement to certain balls, tactically what to do. It's more about game plan, patterns of play. It's more, these are the things that can be better sometimes than the actual technique. Of course, there's going to be minor things from month to month that technically is okay. Maybe keep the racket high, a little bit higher, on the volley, don't drop, on the slice, don't drop the racket head. Those are minor advices that I would give on the tactical level. So most of the improvements improvements I see are more on the tactical side and on the mindset as well.
How do you work the mindset with the player?
You talk. I mean, we spend 24/7 with the player, so there is plenty of time to try and help them be in top mental shape, to keep them motivated, to understand that some days are not, we're all human. Some days are better than others, and sometimes they wake up feeling better, and some days they wake up feeling worse. And I need to try and keep them motivated and get them through those days where they're not feeling their best. But most importantly is the mindset when competing, and the effort and the attitude of being a champion and being positive. This is what you as a coach are always trying to reinforce, the importance of this during the practice, so then hopefully they do it during the match.
Do you consider yourself as a mental coach as well?
No, I mean, I do. I try and help them mentally, yes, but that's definitely not my profession or my strength. I understand, especially after being around it now for a long time, the type of mindset that it takes to be consistent on tour, and the type of dedication and the type of mental engagement that you need as a player if you want to be consistent. You know, for me, it always comes down to what are the goals of the player. If the goals are up here, the standards are up here. If the goals are in the middle, the standards are in the middle. If the goals are low, the standards don't need to be that good. So when you want to be at the top and you want to be excellent or elite, your standards have to be excellent and elite every single day. And I have an idea what those standards are, thankfully, from being around top players. And that's what I push them to do. I push them to make sure the standards of their mindset, the standards of the training, the standards of the recovery are as high as they can be, if that's what the goal is. If the goal is for their, if the goals are in the middle or quite low, then the standards don't need to be that high. So you always, the goals have to, the standards from the player have to match the goals. That's the most important thing.
Yes, but on the tour, the standards, they are always here.
Yeah, but no. But each player has different goals and ambitions on where they want to be. Some players, their goal is maybe to finish the year top 20. Some players, the goal is to finish top 10. Some players is to win Grand Slams and to be number one in the world. And for each bracket of goals, there are different standards. And I'm not saying the standards will guarantee that you will get there, but it will give you a better chance to get there. So that's what I meant. Like, of course, the standards and the level of play is very high from everybody. But what I'm talking about is the performance goals. Depending what your performance goals are, your standards also need to change.
What is the thing you are the most proud of in your career?
Proudest moment was watching Andy get the gold medal in London in 2012. I was the head coach for the British tennis team, the British men's tennis team, and beating Novak in the semis and Roger in the final at Wimbledon. First big result for him before he won the next slam in the US Open. I think that was very special to win that gold medal at home, especially beating Roger in the Wimbledon Centre Court. Yes. So that was a very proud moment.
And is it the most beautiful moment as well?
I would put it up there. The second one that I would consider up there as well was watching Grigor lift the World Tour Finals in 2017 and finish the year number three in the world. In 12 months he went from being ranked I think 55 to number three, and we put in a lot of effort. I mean, I did, but definitely he put in a lot of more effort than I did. So it made me very happy to see such progress in 12 months. And not only that, but to see a player that really wanted it and that really put in the work for 12 months, and to see the results after putting in the work is special, because you have so many, and it happens a lot, you put in the work and the results not always show up. But this time it did, and obviously watching him finish with that trophy and being ranked three in the world, that was also very gratifying.
You talked about the title of Grigor at the ITP Finals, but when you watch Roger, Rafa and Novak always stay at the top, what is your thought? Because it's very difficult to stay at the top.
For me, I always think it's important not to make them part of the norm. Roger, Rafa, Novak,
Andy,
Stan, Delpo, you have to look at them as outliers. They're aliens in a way. They are guys that have taken tennis to a different level, not only some years, but for the last 20 years. And each year, they kept making each other better and better. So for me, that's another thing that I've been extremely fortunate and lucky, is that I've been around this era of tennis week in, week out, competing against them and watching that level of play. So obviously set a certain standard of not only what it takes to get there, but what good level is. For me, obviously what these guys have done is out of this world. And I don't like it also when people say, oh, we'll never see that again, because I'm sure people were saying that about Muhammad Ali and about Michael Jordan back in the day. But sports and tennis, it goes through waves, and you're going to have top players coming through. Of course, achieving something like what these guys achieved is a huge challenge, and it will blow my mind if anyone does it again. But I always leave room for sports and for tennis to give us surprises.
Yes, it's gonna be tough, I think.
Yeah, it's gonna be very tough. But we need to look at the future. Is always bright. I always say, I get asked this question all the time: what do you think is gonna happen when Roger, Rafa, Novak, Andy, when they're all finished at some point? And I said, maybe a few years after, there's gonna be a small dip. But I'm very confident, especially with the new stars coming through, that tennis is in a very, very good place moving forward.
So you are friend with Andy, but are you friend with Rafa, Roger, or Novak?
I mean, we're not best friends, but we know each other. Yeah, we get spend. I call the tour a traveling boarding school. I mean, it is. You travel week in, week out with the same group. You're with everyone in the hotels, with everyone in the locker room, with the same people in the players' lounge, in the restaurants. So we all know each other very well. And lucky for me, I've been, for the last 12-13 years, around the top players late in tournaments when there is not many people around. So then, yeah, you develop a closer relationship. Again, I wouldn't call ourselves best friends, but I would say that we are friends. Yes.
Do you have funny memories, funny stories with the big three on tour?
I have one with Rafa when we were younger. Rafa was playing a futures tournament in the academy. Rafa and I are the same age, and we went to watch a Barcelona game, and we were 16 at the time, and we're coming back from the Barcelona game back to the academy, and when we arrived the main gate was locked because we were coming back too late, so we had to jump the gate, and as soon as we jumped the gate there were two dogs that we didn't see, so we had to run as fast as we could and hide in the gym, I remember, because it was the first door that was in front of us. It was a funny story, but we were shit in our pants. We were very scared. That's when we were 16. And then on tour, not really any really funny ones.
Who was the fastest? You and Rafa with the dogs?
Definitely Rafa. definitely Rafa. I was happy just to be a couple meters behind him.
And not only with the big three, but with other players or with your life on tour, do you have an anecdote or something like that?
Difficult to think of one, to be honest. I mean, the way the tour is, I mean, you go from week to week to week to week, you almost forget so many things, you know. I'm sure if I sat down and I started thinking
about
it. Yes,
if you talk with a friend.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, or even, I'm sure after we finish speaking now, we'll think about it and I'll say, oh, these two would have been funny to tell you, but now on the spot, there's not one that really stands out.
You will send me a vocal message.
Yeah, I'll send you a message, exactly.
Thank you very much, Daniel. See, it's Daniel or Danny?
Danny.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please share it around you if you think about someone that could appreciate it. Put a like on YouTube if you're there, or Apple Podcasts, Spotify. It's stars. It's a matter of stars all the time. So please choose 5. I hope you enjoy today's episode. Have a good time. Take care of you. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.